heartland in north central Indiana. It's the Insurgent Radio Network with Tom Hester, Terrible Tommy, broadcasting live from the bunker in Warsaw, Indiana, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern, where the elite meet to drink, sometimes eat. You can reach Tom at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. You can address your letters of mail to Tom Hester, the Insurgent, or just old plain box holder. Good old Tommy will get it.
Yeah, Insurgent Radio here. You better believe it, right here in north central Indiana, and got a beautiful day here with no rain, no trees blown down, no bridges collapsing. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Thank you for getting your donations in here. And always try to get them in by the 15th for the month we're working on, because sometimes you send them in late and I get them confused whether it's the last month or the next month. It's easy to get Tommy confused, so anyhow, that's it. Now, today we're going to sharpen our pencils, boys and girls, and polish those ballpoint pens and all, and your quills, and we're going to do a little law work today. First, we're going to talk about the lie detectors. Are they feasible? Do they work or do they don't? Well, according to the experts now, or some experts, they don't work worth a damn. The only thing I can say in defense of the lie detector is I think many times it is the fear of the lie detector that actually tells you interesting things about who you're interviewing. But according to this, they're only good in about 50% of the time, which they're saying is like flipping a coin. However, all the agencies use them, but the best system not to be lie detected is to shut up. You have nothing to gain by taking a lie detector. They'll say, well, you want to prove your innocence. You don't have to prove your innocence. You have every right not to talk. It's up to them to prove your guilt. So if you're asked to take a lie detector, I'd turn it down because they're not admissible in court anyhow. Anyhow, here we go with lie detection and also some other comments on the legal system and attorneys and so on and so on.
Deception. He's worked for the FBI, CIA, the military, law enforcement groups. And it goes without saying that all those people Morgan worked with, they really like to know when someone's lying to them. They will do some crazy, expensive, exhaustive things to find out if someone's lying to them. But what we're learning now is that a lot of those things they've been trying, they just don't work. We've been looking for physiological clues since the 1920s for the invention of the lie detector.
This is the Reed polygraph, a lie detector. In the past 20 years, an estimated 200,000 persons have staked their futures, many of them their lives, on this machine.
The polygraph, as you know, is a device that records how fast you're breathing, sort of your respiration rate, and how much your chest is moving. They put tubes around your chest. And the general belief in law enforcement and within the polygraph community for years has been rooted in the idea that we call the fear and alarm hypothesis.
That variations in blood pressure and pulse rate are present during and after the act of lying.
That telling a lie is threatening in some way, and that threat to you will trigger a difference, a shift.
The conscious act of lying creates an emotional disturbance.
And cause your blood pressure to rise, or your skin conductance to go up, or your respiration rate to change, like holding your breath, or maybe breathing more rapidly.
Now, it may not shock you that the polygraph isn't a perfect tool, but we were actually surprised to learn just how inaccurate the machine is.
We actually know the polygraph, in the way it is mainly used, is not better than chance at detecting deception, maybe slightly at 52%, 53%.
You could literally flip a coin and be just as accurate as the polygraph at detecting a lie. But the idea that your body gives you away is still very much alive. It's still being used in police departments all over the country. Cops are trained to read body language. Some investigators claim they can watch an interrogation with the sound off and know if someone's lying. But what Andy Morgan says is that when put to the test, people aren't any better at sensing a lie than chance. And if that's true, that we can't see a lie, that we can't hear a lie or smell a lie, or physically sense in any way when someone's playing us, then what do? About a decade ago, Morgan and some colleagues decided to test a different technique. They started interviewing people from all over the world, about 1,200 of them.
So ranging from white Brits to Chinese, East Indians, Lebanese, Jordanians, Moroccans, Sudanese, Afghans, Iraqis, Vietnamese, Russians. My colleagues and I have tried to study people inside and outside the United States, and we've mainly used a particular technique called cognitive interviewing.
Cognitive interviewing is based on the premise that memory doesn't work like a video camera. There are sights and sounds and smells stored deep in your brain that can all be recalled if pushed hard enough. So every time Morgan sat down to interview an American or a Jordanian, some of them would be lying and others would be telling the truth. And he would ask them to do something pretty simple.
To tell us a story about what they've been doing.
The most memorable concert that I've been to, it's not the best, it's the most memorable.
So obviously this isn't actually tape for Morgan's research. We just put some of our friends to the test.
Was Yay Sayer, about a year ago.
I went to a Foo Fighters concert in 2005 for the In Your Honor tour.
And then say, so if you imagine for a minute that I was there with you, what would I have seen if I'd been there with you the entire time?
They had the lights programmed with the music, and so the mirrors really like reflected the light, and so there was like it would form shapes.
Then we say when they're done, so I think I'm getting a better picture in my head. So imagine for a moment I was with you, but this time I was blind and I could only listen. What would I have heard during that time?
So it's more of a shuffling of like rubber against pavement there. Go down metal steps, go down to the car, all car doors open.
You know, depending on the context, you might say, what would I have smelled?
There was this girl that was standing next to me who was in a sweater dress. You did not wear deodorant.
And then they say, starting with the very last thing that happened, what do you remember happening right before that?
Leave dorm.
Right before that.
Go walk backwards to car.
Right before that.
Get in car. Come back to dorm.
Kind of having them walk us backwards through their memory.
Crunching guitars and awesome drum stuff.
What's been found over the years in many studies of cognitive interviewing is that using those mnemonic prompts, those sensory prompts, what you have seen, heard, smelled, thought, touched, or tasted, they trigger more memory recall. You get more detail. The picture becomes much more rich and complex without suggesting anything specific to the person you're interviewing.
But here's where things get interesting. Turns out, if you're telling a lie, a made-up story, even one that's well-rehearsed, you can't complete this interview, not without giving yourself away.
If you tell a very simple lie, there's not much work to you. You go, I don't know. And you have nothing to say. Kids do that all the time. But if you're telling a story that's reasonably complicated and it's supposed to be believable, because if I'm lying to you, my goal is to sell you the story I'm telling you and then to leave before you figure out it's not true, or not to bring up anything that might lead you to suspect that it's not true. I'm trying to tell my story and stick to it. We find that liars are often worried that if they're inconsistent, they will be thought to be lying. So what they do is they tell you a story. So if I say, tell me everything that happened, they might tell me quite a wonderful story.
I went to see Florence and the Machine. It was like in the spring.
But then when I say, so let's go back to the beginning. So imagine I was with you. What would I have seen, you know, heard, thought, smelled, touched, tasted, or walked through it backwards? The overall result is they have very little to say.
Can you move the car right home?
Not really.
They will say things like, well, pretty much just like I told you before, and they will repeat very closely the same thing they've already told me, so that I'm not learning anything new over time.
The thing is, I don't even really remember.
It's sort of like comparing a digital photograph of your house with the tree in the front yard and a child's picture of it, where there's a house and there's a tree and there's clouds and there's birds, but there's not a lot of detail. And what we tend to do when people tell us lies is I think we fill in the blanks.
And that, Morgan says, is where the problem lies. We fill in the blanks because, of course, we want to believe people. So Andy Morgan's challenge was to find a way to take these interviews and analyze them without filling in the blanks. To do this, he had to put a little distance between himself and the interesting person telling the story.
The way we've analyzed that in most of our studies is we record the interviews and we do a transcript and we let the computer just count the number of words that comes out of a person's mouth in the interview and the number of unique words that comes out of their mouth. So if you think about the phrase, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. There are 10 words, but you've used 1 and 4 twice. So there's only 8 unique words. As you're thinking harder about monitoring what you're saying, it has the side effect of reducing the richness of what you have to say and shortens the thing that you have to say. All the computer is doing is counting those two variables. And when we sort people based on those two variables, response length and unique word count, the computer's right typically 80 to 85% of the time. Whereas our professional raiders, whether they come from Homeland Security or the FBI or the DIA or other intelligence groups or law enforcement, our human raiders are rarely better than 54% correct.
Crazy idea that someone with a transcript and a tally sheet could tell us whether or not what we're remembering is accurate, while someone with decades of FBI interrogation training could be flying blind. And this idea could have all sorts of huge implications. Think about a jury. A jury is just a bunch of people trying to figure out who to believe. But people, according to Andy Morgan, are terrible at figuring out who to believe. Isn't it possible that a juror with a transcript of the trial who's never laid eyes on the accused might actually do a better job at figuring out who's lying, who to trust? For Andy Morgan's part, he's glad our bodies aren't the end-all be-all.
It's reassuring to know that although there's so many books on nonverbal behavior and people say 90% of communication is nonverbal, based on the science, I think that the best way to sort out the truth is to listen to what people have to say.
And to know that maybe our fate won't hang on sweaty palms or pounding heart, that our words really do matter. Thanks to Andy Morgan, who's a forensic psychologist at Yale. And just in case you were curious, during his interview with us, he used more than 7,200 words. And enough unique words to make us trust he wasn't lying. The show is produced by Lauren Spohr.
1945.
More than the policeman on the corner. More than the courthouse where our laws are enforced. More than the jail where lawbreakers are punished. In your whole community, there are customs and moral codes which guide your actions.
What social controls affect you?
So now we have this bizarre, weird, secret power. Trial judge doesn't have to tell you about it, then I sure can.
The risk is people get away with murder.
This is Life of the Law. I'm Nancy Mullane. In the U.S., it's a civic duty. Anyone charged with a crime who can be punished with more than 6 months in jail or prison has the constitutional right to a trial by a jury of their peers. That's you and me. In the 1970s, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled it's up to each state to decide whether to have 6 or 12 jurors on a trial, and only 2 states, Georgia and Louisiana, allow anything less than a unanimous decision to convict someone in a criminal case. Even with the Constitution guaranteeing a jury trial, there's been a big drop in the number of civil trials going to a jury, with fewer today than 40 years ago. And maybe that has something to do with the tremendous power juries have to decide more than guilt or innocence. Shannon Heffernan has the story.
Paul Butler grew up in a black neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. He was a smart, talented kid and ended up going to Harvard Law School. When he graduated, he wanted to do something for communities like the one he grew up in. Black communities were besieged by crime, so he became a prosecutor.
So I thought, I'm going to go in as this undercover brother, and I'm going to make a difference from the inside.
But as a prosecutor, Butler had to put a lot of people behind bars.
And it turned out that I was kind of good at that. You know, I was like this, you know, this clean-cut black guy, and most of the jurors in D.C. were black. And they would just beam at me when I said, my name is Paul Butler, I represent the government. They'd almost do whatever I wanted.
Almost. Except when it came to petty drug cases. Even when it was very clear someone was guilty, juries came back with an innocent verdict. Butler was confused. Why would they let someone they knew was guilty of a drug charge go free? Then, one day he's prosecuting one of these cases.
And the defense was something like, well, yeah, the police caught me with the drugs, but they weren't mine. And yeah, I was like, okay. You know, for the law, it actually doesn't matter. If the drugs are on you, it's what's called a strict liability crime. So you're guilty. So the judge told that to the jurors. Jury went out, they deliberated, and they came back with a big fat not guilty. I was like, oh my God, what's up? So I was right out there outside the jury, the room where they come out, and none of the black jurors would talk to me. And the white woman stopped for a moment. And I said, what happened? And she said, we all knew he was guilty, but he's so young.
Even if the jurors thought the boy was too young, the law was still the law. Butler asked the more experienced prosecutors what was going on. It turned out it had a name, jury nullification. When a jury nullifies, it finds a defendant innocent, although the jurors may actually believe he's guilty. And because it's illegal to retry someone, the person goes free. The prosecutors Butler talked to hated it. They thought it weakened the legal system. But nullification has played a big role in American history. Jurors used it all the way back during the Revolutionary War to free Americans who spoke out against the British, and during Prohibition to keep bootleggers out of jail. Most famously, it was used during slavery.
Imagine you were a juror in 1850, and it was against the law to help a slave run away. And so jurors would often say not guilty, even though these folks were 100% guilty. By the way, those jurors also helped create the conditions that led to the abolition of slavery. And I ask folks now, well, what would you do?
It seems like an easy answer. Slavery is wrong. But jury nullification has a dark side, too.
I don't think anyone could really advocate for a system where the juries can do whatever they want to do.
Jeff Kramer is the managing director of Kroll Investigations and has tried at least 100 jury trials. Kramer says juries have used nullification to do things we look back on as being right, but they've also used nullification to do things that were really wrong.
Butler was so badly damaged that we couldn't hardly just tell who he was, but he happened to have on a ring with his initials.
In August of 1955, two white men killed Emmett Till, a black 14-year-old who they said whistled at a white woman.
We never have any trouble until some of our southern niggas go up north and NAACP talks to them and they come back home. I'd like for the NAACP to know that we are here giving all parties a fair and impartial trial.
The trial was not fair. The evidence was clear. Later, the two white defendants would even admit to the murder. But the all-white jury found the white defendants innocent. That was nullification, too. Again, Jeff Kramer.
The risk is people get away with murder. And they get away with murder because the jury in those cases regarded the defendants as more valuable than the victims. So if we allowed jury nullification, system's over. It doesn't work. It's broken.
There is nobody who will tell you that the jurors are anything but serious and impressed with the magnitude of the task that they've been given.
Sherry Diamond is a professor at Northwestern Law School. Jury deliberation is usually very private, but Diamond received rare permission to study them in action. Her conclusion? Nullification doesn't happen often.
The jurors will say, boy, I sure don't agree with that law, but we have no choice.
Of course, juries are a cross-section of society with all its flaws. But Diamond says you have to remember that in order to be on a jury, you have to first get through the selection process. That weeds out people with biases, people who might nullify.
So the jury is us, but perhaps a better us.
That better us will nullify in rare circumstances, usually when our accepted morals don't match the letter of the law.
One way of saying it is that this is a kind of safety valve for the system, and we tolerate it, and there are, in fact, court opinions that say specifically that the jury has no right to do it. But, of course, we structurally build a system in which the jury has the power to do it.
Jury nullification dates all the way back to common law. It was designed as a check and balance on the government's power. Paul Butler, the prosecutor who was having trouble getting guilty verdicts, thinks it may be the most direct form of democracy we have. 12 people in a room charged with coming to a single conclusion. He left the prosecutor's office and became a professor at George Washington University. He now believes those jurors who nullified in all those drug cases were onto something.
There are more blacks who are under criminal justice supervision now than there were slaves in 1850.
Butler thinks drug laws are to blame for those high incarceration numbers. Statistically, there are less black drug users, but more blacks in prison for drugs. So just like jurors nullified the fugitive slave laws, Butler thinks modern jurors should nullify drug laws.
Sometimes the law really is unfair. And sometimes jurors really should say that people are not guilty, even if they committed the crime, especially if it's a drug case, because the drug laws are selectively enforced, and I don't think it's fair.
Now, despite the role nullification can play, chances are you haven't heard of it, and there's a reason for that. Most people in the legal system think juries shouldn't nullify. It's too dangerous. Still, they can't take away jurors' ability to nullify without taking away other basic rights enshrined in the Constitution. But there are three ways the legal system tries to discourage nullification. First, as a juror, you take an oath.
Do each of you solemnly swear that you will render a true verdict according to the law and the evidence, so help you God?
Second, defense lawyers cannot tell jurors to nullify. They can only raise doubts that their client didn't commit the crime.
Members of the jury, these are the facts, and I am confident today you will see this case is full of reasonable doubt.
Third, most judges basically tell you not to nullify.
It is your responsibility to decide what the facts of this case may be and to apply the law to those facts.
So, juries may be able to nullify, but the system is set up to hide that.
So now we have this bizarre, weird secret power that one of my functions is, if the trial judge doesn't have to tell you about it, then I sure can.
Butler tries to spread the word about nullification through speaking and writing. Another activist takes a more direct approach.
Oh, I'm Julian Heiklin, and I am the biggest pain in the ass in the world.
Heiklin is a member of the Fully Informed Jury Association. Their goal is to make sure jurors know they can nullify. Heiklin stands outside courtrooms, handing out literature and talking to people. He thinks nullification is a good strategy for all kinds of laws he sees as being unfair, including gun laws. In August of 2011, the U.S. government charged Heiklin with jury tampering, a serious offense. The case got a lot of attention, especially when the judge denied Heiklin a jury trial. After all, it would be just another opportunity for him to tell jurors how to nullify. But if the courts want to keep this jury nullification thing on the down low, then Heiklin says the joke has been on them.
So they've made a national issue out of this. They've done something that I could have never done by myself. This is all over the country. All of a sudden, I've become a major public figure, and I'm just a shabby old man with a few ridiculous pamphlets.
They're handing out the biggest pamphlet ever.
Of course, they're handing out the biggest pamphlet ever.
Since I spoke with Heiklin, the case has been dropped. He plans to be outside courtrooms again soon, for better or worse, making the secret power of nullification a little less secret.
Now you've got some law. I think I ran that once before, a couple of weeks ago. I'm not sure on that jury nullification, but it's important you understand it, and it's important for lone wolves because, as a lone wolf, you can get on a jury if, you know, try to get on a jury, and if it's somebody you like, just vote not guilty. On a felony, it only takes one. So there's no reason in the world why, of course, you're going to have to fib a little bit, probably, you know, because they're going to try to pin you down and voir dire. That's what they call that when both sides get to interview prospective jurors. And that's what I said the last time I was picked to be a juror. I stood up and said that I will judge the law and the crime. In other words, if I don't think the law is just, I'm going to vote not guilty, no matter whether the guy did it or not. And boy, they got me out of that room so fast, it was unbelievable. Yeah. Now, the sad part about it is blacks are much more prone to understand this and go along with this than whites. Whites are, you know, try to be so sophisticated and we respect the law and God bless America and all that stuff, where blacks tend to think more racially. And so, in fact, I wish every black would do that and just screw up the courts really good. Spread some legal anarchy there. And then maybe whites had learned something. They should have learned something after the O.J. Simpson trial out in L.A., where his trial was very cleverly moved from West L.A. downtown, where juries were mostly black. If he'd have been tried in West L.A., he'd have been convicted of murder. There was no doubt about that. Well, I see that the Islamics over there in the Middle East have entitled their outfit now the Islamic State, which I think is a very smart move, a very, very smart move on their part. These guys have got plenty of money behind them now because they've gotten contributions from all over the place, plus they've knocked over a whole bunch of banks, hauled away a lot of gold bullion and so forth, so they're quite wealthy as a guerrilla outfit, as an unconventional war outfit, and now to call themselves the Islamic State, that is genius. And that's going to cause the military-industrial complex of the United States and Israel and Europe and England a whole lot of headaches. That's fine. Let's hear a little bit from the head of the FBI here. I don't think I've run this, but if I have, you need to hear it again anyhow. I don't know. He's talking about lone wolves. I'm not talking about you and me because we're not in the bedroom or the living room. We're in the bunker.
I'm worrying about it. I'm particularly worried about the confluence of that virulence among these progeny of Al-Qaeda with Syria. Syria has become the breeding ground, the training ground for thousands of jihadis from around the world, including dozens and dozens from the United States. All of us who know history can draw a line from Afghanistan in the 1980s to 9/11. We are determined not to allow a line from today's Syria to be drawn to future 9/11s. We are determined to anticipate the diaspora of terrorists that's going to happen at some point out of Syria and respond to it aggressively in advance. And as you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, we also face a challenge from these people we call homegrown violent extremists, Some call them lone wolves. I don't like the term. It conveys dignity they don't deserve. But these are people who are not directed by Al-Qaeda, but are inspired and trained, again, through the information available on the Internet, to then emerge from their basement or their bedroom and do something terrible, something we spend a great deal of time worrying about. And domestic terrorism, Mr. Chairman, I think, as the members of this committee know, is something the FBI has long worked. My domestic terrorism operations unit has been busy for the last 20 years. Nothing has changed for us in that regard. It's something we spend a lot of time worrying about and apply resources to make sure we anticipate and address. As I said, we are a national security organization. Counterterrorism is part of that. Counterintelligence is a big part of that. Something we can't talk about in open session because most of that work is done in the shadows. But it is an important part of our work, done extremely well all around the world by my folks. And we are also a law enforcement organization. We're out there every day trying to lock up violent criminals, people who would harm your kids, corrupt public officials, and all manner of bad guys that touch our criminal investigative responsibilities that remain combined with our national security responsibilities in ways that make sense to me. And I'll close just by saying that as you and Mr. Conyers have alluded to, lots of folks are asking good questions these days about government power, and that's a great thing. People should be skeptical of government power. I am. I think the country was founded by people who were very skeptical of government power, so they divided it among three branches to balance it. I think it's great that people ask questions. I think one of my jobs is, to the extent I can, to answer those questions. And I hope folks will give me the space and time in American public life to listen to the answers, because there's an angel in the details of my work. There's a reason why it matters that I be able to get lawful process to search and get content of some bad guy who's emailing about a terrorist plot or a criminal enterprise. There's a reason I need to be able to track with lawful process the location through a cell phone of someone who's kidnapped a child or is fleeing from justice. All those things matter a great deal. Those details matter, and I believe those details reflect our government working as it should. Hard for me to find that space and time in the windstorm I live in right now. And last, thank you again on behalf of the people of the FBI. We don't have a lot of stuff. We don't have aircraft carriers. We don't have satellites. I got amazing people. That's the magic of the FBI. Thank you for the resources for me to be able to hire those folks. It was a thrill for me to see new agents at Quantico last week and new intelligence analysts. That is the lifeblood of this great institution, and it's what makes it a thrill and an honor for me to be the director. So I look forward to your questions.
At radical pro-life groups, not surprisingly, the prison system is an incubator of extremism. And finally, although most extremists are not terrorists, most terrorists have been influenced by extremist subcultures, so I'll discuss extremist terrorism as well. In addition, I'll discuss some signs of convergence in extremist subcultures. The cases of Tamerlan Zarnaev in America and Dieudonné in France illustrate this trend. And finally, in the conclusion, I'll talk about the implications of some current trends and how they relate to political extremism. So my book endeavors to put these variants of extremism in context. So first, let's look at the extreme right. During the 1990s, the extreme right appeared to gain ground as a social movement, but the movement suffered a series of setbacks in the aftermath of 9/11. Many of the movement's key leaders died or were arrested and prosecuted. But the financial crisis in 2008 and the election of Barack Obama that same year catalyzed the movement. In 2011, the Southern Poverty Law Center, that's a monitoring organization based in Montgomery, Alabama, it announced that the number of so-called hate groups had reached over 1,000. Furthermore, the number of so-called patriot and militia groups topped 800. These were the largest figures ever recorded since the Southern Poverty Law Center began counting such groups in the 1980s. The extreme right exhibits an acute disaffection with the government, the federal government in particular. People in this movement often have a conspiratorial worldview. They tend to look beneath the surface of American politics and find elite cabals at work, subverting society. Finally, the extreme right often espouses an element of racism and anti-Semitism. Now, in recent years, the American extreme right saw an opportunity to ride the new populist wave in the form of the Tea Party. Although less radical, the Tea Party movement echoes some of the same themes as the far right. For example, the Tea Party movement is also very critical and suspicious of the federal government. And many people who identify with the Tea Party voice concern over immigration policy. However, the public representatives of the Tea Party do not use the racialist and extremist rhetoric that is common in the extreme right subculture. Nevertheless, there's a persistent recession. A persistent recession has really brought a substantial increase in unemployment and a decline in life opportunities for many people who were formerly part of the middle class. What's more, uneasiness over immigration could galvanize support for both the white nationalist and patriot segments of the extreme right, insofar as immigration informs other issues that typically resonate with conservative voters, issues such as welfare, health care, and multiculturalism. So, in short, the issues that give rise to the extreme right will become more pronounced in this century, and so as a consequence, the movement could gain traction despite the formidable opposition arrayed against it. Now, although the demographic profiles of members of the far right and the Tea Party are similar in some respects, there is still much that divides the two movements over ideology. In order to be viable in the long term, the Tea Party really must coalesce around some kind of unifying platform and set of principles that can be presented to the American public. And so whether the Tea Party can connect with a large segment of America's increasing non-white population will, in large measure, determine its electoral viability. So if the Tea Party fails in this respect, it could coalesce with the extreme right and be moved in a more radical direction. Jose Zerquet analyzed the anti-globalization and the new anarchist movement. The new anarchists seek to create an alternative globalization to replace the capitalist economy with one that is more egalitarian and based on left-wing precepts. Now, initially after the Cold War, far-left groups lost a credible ideology. The collapse of the Soviet Union ushered in a new era of global integration. But despite the setback, the far-left managed to reinvent itself. So the anti-globalization movement resonates with sections of disaffected young people around the world. These anarchists have disrupted many cities, cities that have hosted meetings and conferences by globalist organizations. For example, back in the fall of 1999, there was a disparate collection of protesters. They interrupted the World Trade Organization meeting that was taking place in Seattle. Through their protest, these new anarchists seek to hasten the demise of global capitalism, which they believe is in a state of terminal crisis. And although these groups have not been responsible for fatalities, the Department of Homeland Security has identified these new anarchist groups as a serious potential security threat because of their potential to disrupt major cities. Moving on to black nationalism. There are several variants of black nationalism today, including groups like the Nation of Islam, the Black Hebrew Sect, and the New Black Panther Party. At times, the black nationalist movement has been repressed, as witnessed by the FBI's COINTELPRO operations back in the 1960s and early 70s. COINTELPRO was an illegal and secret FBI program. It sought to disrupt and neutralize various dissident groups in America. But it's worth mentioning that on occasion, representatives of the black nationalist movement have garnered significant grassroots support, as evidenced by Minister Louis Farrakhan's Million Man March in Washington, D.C. back in 1995. Darren Malloy examined one of the most radical manifestations of contemporary black nationalism, that is to say, the New Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. This group was founded in 1990. Malik Chavez is the founder and current leader of the group. The New Black Panther Party holds racist, conspiratorial, and anti-Semitic beliefs. On occasion, members of the group have supported radical Islamist causes as well. For instance, members of the group protested at the Danish embassy back in 2006 during the controversy surrounding a cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad that appeared in a Danish newspaper around that time. The group also offered support and legal advice to Zacharias Massaoui. Massaoui is the alleged 20th 9/11 hijacker. So this increasingly radical posture has alienated the new group from some of the activists of the original Black Panther Party. It's worth mentioning that explicit black racial advocacy has significant support in America, both in the mainstream and on the fringe. For example, there are public figures, politicians, well-respected interest groups such as the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. They often endorse the principles of black solidarity and empowerment, but usually without the rhetoric of conspiracies and racial antagonism. For example, Barack Obama. He expressed his ambivalent feelings for black nationalism in his autobiography, Dreams of My Father. In the book, he condoned black nationalism's message of solidarity, self-reliance, and communal responsibility. But on the other hand, he sought to kind of disentangle that message with elements of hatred of white people. Donald Truett took a close look at Chicano nationalism in the United States. This movement seeks to implement its nationalist vision in the American Southwest. They call this aspirational homeland Aztalan. Aztalan is envisioned to be a Spanish-speaking Chicano nation. So political identity for members of this movement is primarily defined by race, ethnicity, and language. Now, at first blush, creating an Aztlan nation on American territory might seem rather far-fetched. However, the rapidly changing demographic profile of the Southwest emboldens Chicano separatists to believe that at least a cultural Anschluss or unification with Mexico is inevitable someday. It hopes to accomplish this through extensive demographic change produced by both legal and illegal immigration. And it is hoped that this large population of undocumented immigrants will eventually obtain legal status, and then they'll become a very powerful voting bloc. Chicano activists are also encouraged by the high birth rate of their newly arrived constituents. With the political majority, the Chicano separatist movement could eventually secure an independent state through the electoral process. And by doing so, there would be no need for armed conflict. So currently, the movement really minimizes the role of violence in bringing about its goal of a separate Aztlan nation composed almost exclusively of Latinos. But the establishment of such a political entity presupposes ethnic cleansing writ large. So the popularity of multiculturalism among the American elite has really provided cover for the Chicano separatists. Their irredentist aspirations might normally be rejected as chauvinistic and exclusionary. And although this movement is confined primarily to the American Southwest, Chicano separatism has gained quite a bit of support, not only among scholars and students in Chicano studies departments, but among some non-academics as well. James and Brenda Lutz examined Islamic extremism in the United States. Now, historically, Islamist activity in America centered more on fundraising rather than on terrorism. Prior to 9/11, there were really only a few incidents of terrorism by Islamic extremists in America. The first major incident was the attack on the World Trade Center in 1993. Ramzi Youssef was the mastermind of that attack. Later transpired that he was affiliated with Al-Qaeda. Because of America's porous borders, radical Islamists were able to establish a presence in America. And this, of course, culminated in the 9/11 terrorist attacks in New York City and Washington, D.C. In the aftermath of 9/11, there was quite a bit of fear that sleeper cells might spring into action. And although these fears later transpired to be overblown, there had been a number of plots that had been uncovered. And some of the deadlier attacks to date have come from solitary individuals who have self-identified with the global jihad. For example, back in November of 2009, Major Nidal Hassan went on a shooting rampage at Fort Hood, Texas, which killed 13 people and wounded 31 people. A few months later, Faisal Shahzad, he attempted to detonate a car bomb in Times Square in New York City. To be expected, U.S. authorities are concerned about radical Islam in America. In March of 2011, Congress held hearings called by Representative Peter King on the topic. Another worrisome prospect is that Islamic terrorists might strike Jewish targets in America. Because much of the Jewish diaspora supports Israel, Muslim terrorists occasionally attack Jewish targets outside of Israel. And conceivably, such violence could embolden Jewish extremists in America. James and Brenda Luntz, they also looked at Jewish extremism in America. Now, when compared to other countries in which the diaspora has resided, anti-Semitism in America has been comparatively low. Nevertheless, episodes of anti-Semitism have punctuated American history. Anti-Semitism was most pronounced in the early part of the 20th century when Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe settled en masse in some American cities. Now, mainstream Jewish organizations have defended Jewish rights, but there have been some Jewish extremist organizations that have been active as well. The best known of these groups is the Jewish Defense League. This group was created in 1968 in response to a conflict in New York City involving the public schools. At that time, many of the teachers were Jewish and many of the pupils were African American. At the time, there were some tensions between the two communities. However, the rise of Jewish extremism in the United States has been largely linked to events overseas. During the 1970s and the 1980s, the Jewish Defense League targeted representatives of the Soviet Union because of the failure of that country to allow its Jewish citizens to emigrate. The Jewish Defense League also targeted Arab American groups, anti-Semitic groups, and Holocaust revisionists. There was also an offshoot organization called the Jewish Defense Organization. Now, these extremist Jewish defense groups are overshadowed by the mainstream organizations, such as the Anti-Defamation League, the American Jewish Congress, and the American Jewish Committee. These mainstream groups, they're very well funded. They enjoy substantial support not only from the Jewish community, but also leading politicians and civic leaders. But despite their effort, anti-Jewish sentiment still persists in some quarters today. For example, on the extreme right, Jews are often implicated in a sinister conspiracy to defile the white race, allegedly by promoting multiculturalism and non-white immigration into America. On the political left, some activists decry Israeli's actions against the Palestinians. They've organized divestment campaigns against Israel. In addition, some Muslims criticize what they believe is the U.S. government's unfair policies that support Israel at the expense of the Palestinians. Now, by contrast, the Christian right has been one of the most consistently pro-Israel blocs, but there are some segments of Christianity in America that have an anti-Jewish animus. I examined the Christian Identity Movement. This is a religious sect that has gained popularity in the American extreme right subculture. Christian Identity is a religion that has its origins in something known as British Israelism, which first gained popularity in England in the 19th century. This creed posits that the people of northwestern Europe are the true descendants of the 10 lost tribes of Israel. In the early 20th century, the sect found its way to America and it later metamorphosed into Christian identity. So this cult has an apocalyptic eschatology in which Armageddon is framed in racialist terms. And this theology has served as an inspiration for some of the most violent members of the extreme right. Some elements of the Christian identity movement have been involved in the radical pro-life movement, such as Eric Rudolph. Eric Rudolph was a young man. He drifted in and out of white supremacist groups before embarking on his one-man campaign of violence. Aaron Winter examined the history of extreme anti-abortion activism in the United States. In particular, he took a close look at so-called militant direct organizations such as Operation Rescue and Lambs of Christ, and also groups that advocate violence against abortion providers and patients, such as the Army of God. There have been numerous lone wolves, including James Koop, Scott Roeder, and Paul Hill. They've carried out assassinations against abortion providers. The pro-life movement illustrates the overlap between radical and mainstream groups. To a limited extent, the mainstream pro-life movement provides organizational and grassroots support for the more extreme activists. But the abortion issue continues to polarize America. Political leaders tend to handle the issue very gingerly. On the conservative right, pro-life sentiments have been expressed by U.S. presidents, including Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. But more often than not, the mainstream conservatives tend to disassociate themselves from the radical elements of the pro-life movement. The violent pro-life activists have been condemned by leading public figures and the media. For example, the murder of Dr. George Tiller back in 2009 occasioned condemnation throughout America. And there has been legislation which has been enacted to protect reproductive rights. For instance, the Freedom of Clinic Entrances Act of 1994 imposed restrictions on abortion clinic protests. But even on the political left, pro-choice candidates are reluctant to come out unequivocally for reproductive rights. Instead, they couch their support in the guarded language of individual choice. Now, anti-abortion activists often identify with the black civil rights movement. They see themselves as following in that American tradition. By contrast, they place their opponents, the abortion clinics, as following in the tradition of the Nazi death camps. Let's move on to eco-extremism. Donald Liddick looked at radical environmentalist and animal liberation movements. The eco-extremists are drawn from the ranks of mainstream groups, but they have become disaffected with conventional political lobbying. Instead, they opt for so-called direct action techniques. Groups such as the Earth Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front, they've adopted a variety of criminal means to bring about a diverse range of goals. Some of the most extreme elements, such as the Unabomber Ted Kaczynski, they advocate the collapse of technological civilization. Now, the eco-extremists have been responsible for a considerable amount of property damage, though not many fatalities. There are indications, however, that some people in the movement have adopted a more apocalyptic and misanthropic worldview. So as a consequence, they could be inclined to wage lethal attacks in the future. Since the 1990s, the FBI has identified eco-extremists as a very serious domestic terrorism threat. Jeffrey Ian Ross, he explored extremism in American prisons. Various politically expedient get-tough approaches to crime have resulted in chronically overcrowded prisons. And prisons are often incubators of extremism for obvious reasons. The violent and harsh milieu of prisons can contribute to the radicalization of inmates. The 1960s and 1970s were really the formative years for the development of prison gangs. Around that time, the prison population was desegregated, and this diminished the stable prison culture that had prevailed for many years. It really contributed to a polarization between the various racial and ethnic groups in prison. So a wide variety of extremist orientations are represented in the prison population. Presently, most of the gangs are organized along the lines of race and ethnicity. Some of the more notable gangs include the Black Guerrilla Family, the Mexican Mafia, and the Aryan Brotherhood. Usually, to be inducted into one of these gangs, a prospective member must carry out what's known as a blood-in, blood-out requirement. Blood-in basically means that the recruit must stab a member of a rival gang. Blood-out means that it's very difficult to leave the gang once a recruit has been inducted into the group. Ominously, the microcosm of the prison could be a bellwether of what lies ahead for America. Christopher Hewitt discussed domestic terrorism in the United States and its perpetrators. He argues that terrorism has occurred in a series of waves. According to Hewitt, terrorism is almost always linked to a wider social movement. For instance, Ku Klux Klan terrorism in the South was part of a broader pattern of white resistance to the civil rights struggle. Black terrorism, including killings by the Black Liberation Army, was associated with the rise of the Black Power movement. Left-wing terrorism emerged in the context of widespread student opposition to the Vietnam War. So terrorism tends to occur after a social movement enjoyed a period of growth and success. So in order to understand domestic terrorism, it must be located within its political and social context. Now, Hewitt's research suggests that terrorism does not flourish because politicians and opinion leaders pander to extremists. Rather, the opposite appears to be true. That is to say, extremists are more likely to move to terrorism under hostile governmental administrations. Finally, a distinguishing characteristic of political violence in America that Hewitt noted was that a significant proportion of terrorist acts are committed by unaffiliated individuals rather than formal members of terrorist organizations. Although there is a great deal of hostility among the various extremist subcultures, at times their ideologies overlap. Some are obvious. For example, environmental and animal liberation activists, they're usually more comfortable in the political left. The far left is more likely to be sympathetic to groups that espouse minority rights, even those that are chauvinistic, as in the case of the New Black Panther Party or Chicano Nationalists, and even radical Islamists. On the other hand, anti-abortion activists are more likely to find a sympathetic milieu in the extreme right and the Christian identity movement. There are instances, though, of strange bedfellows alliances, which, when examined closely, follow a consistent logic. For example, despite their differences, on occasion, black and white separatists have made common cause in their efforts to establish a dialogue on cooperating to achieve their goals. So such tactical alliances of convenience make sense when taken to their logical conclusion. For the extreme right and radical Islam, there is a meeting of the minds on several issues. For instance, the two movements decry the pro-Israel orientation of American foreign policy in the Middle East. And it's worth mentioning that anti-Semitism looms large in these extremist subcultures among a variety of political movements. For example, in recent years, the far left has been critical of Israel and has been in the forefront of the divestment campaign against the country, not unlike the campaign against the apartheid-era government of South Africa back in the 1980s. Blacks and Jews formed an alliance during the civil rights era, but at times that special relationship has been strained, as the case of Louis Farrakhan and his Nation of Islam illustrates. Today, radical Islamists identify Jews in Israel as among their primary enemies. And in the cauldron of American prisons, extremist hostility to Jews is commonplace. And the Ashkelon movement that I discussed earlier also has a very strident critique of Israel. They identify Palestinians as comrades in the fight against imperialism. So to further illustrate these convergences, let me talk about Tamerlan Tsarnaev. His case illustrates how extremists can be kind of eclectic and their worldviews. As one of his acquaintances noted, Tamerlan Tsarnaev was a Muslim of convenience in the sense that he used the plight of embattled Muslims around the world as kind of an allegory for his own personal failures. Now, for most of his life, he rarely prayed, but after his boxing career faltered, he increasingly latched on to radical Islam. For example, he read Al-Qaeda's online English language magazine, Inspire. But right-wing literature informed his worldview as well. For instance, he was an avid follower of Alex Jones's InfoWars website. The website peddles numerous conspiracy theories. For example, 9/11 was an inside job carried out by U.S. intelligence agencies. Some of his reading material espoused white supremacy. For instance, in his reading collection was a copy of the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. This is an early 20th century tract. It purports to be the minutes of a secret meeting of Zionist leaders who planned this fantastic plot to conquer the world and then enslave Gentiles. The short but influential tract has long been a staple in the literature of the extreme right, and more recently among anti-Zionists in the Muslim world as well. Now, on the surface, these political views might seem divergent, but there's actually some common ground. Extremists on the right see Jews as the principal enemy of the so-called Aryan people. And although radical Islam generally eschews racial themes, its version of anti-Zionism in many ways parallels the version of anti-Semitism found in the extreme right subculture. Both the extreme right and radical Islam charge that there's a Jewish conspiracy that's undermining their societies. So Tamerlan identified himself as part of a besieged Muslim ummah that was under attack by both the United States and Israel. An even better example of convergence is from overseas in France. That is the case of Dieudonné Mambala Mambala. He's a controversial French comedian and political activist of African descent. In his stand-up routines, he's often very critical of Israel and Zionism. So extremists from across the political spectrum are attracted to his message, including people on the far left, the far right, Holocaust revisionists, and anti-Zionists. He created and popularized what critics call a kind of modified version of the Hitler salute or the Roman salute. It's called the Canal. Now, for his part, he denies that it's supposed to be a Nazi salute, but that's how his critics interpret it. He claims it's just an anti-establishment symbolic gesture. Back in December of last year, a French soccer player, Nicolas Anelka, he sparked controversy when he made that gesture after scoring a goal in an important soccer game. So this gesture has really caught on in France with young people. Extremists from across the political spectrum have spoken out in defense of Dieudonné. For example, David Duke, the white nationalist, defended him on his website. Likewise, Gilad Atzmon, the jazz musician and the outspoken Jewish critic of Israel and Judaism, he recently wrote an article in which he defended Dieudonné. At the present time, the future of political extremism in America is far from certain, but there are several important social, political, economic, and demographic trends that could have far-reaching consequences in this century. For instance, according to Census Bureau projections, by the year 2050, whites will no longer comprise a majority of the American population, due in large part to increases in both the Hispanic and Asian segments of the population. Now, this development is viewed in nearly apocalyptic terms in the white nationalist segment of the extreme right. Now, by contrast, in the Chicano nationalist movement, this proposition is often greeted with a sense of triumphalism because it prepares the way for the eventual reconquista of the American Southwest. Other trends, such as chronic instability in the Middle East, could exacerbate tensions between the Muslim and Jewish populations in America. And the festering economic crisis could create a greater pull of the dispossessed that will support radical movements in the future.
Well, there you go. School's out for today on Dave Lane's Day, Wotan's Day. You better have learned something. You better have learned something, and you better remember it, because you're going to need it someday. If not now, later. 14-5. You know, I got some 14-5 shirts in here somebody sent me. 14-5, and then it says, shut up. I think that might have been Stray Dog. Send me $10, I'll send you one. How about that, okay? Off and clear.